providing for an effective date. House Bill 535 was scheduled today and will not be taking testimony or hearing that bill today. It's been rescheduled. And we begin today's hearing with House Bill 313, enacting relating to certain mental health insurance policies to cover treatment of mental illness conditions. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate all the interest in this piece of legislation. It's really proud. Now, I just want to make a couple of opening comments on the legislation, and then there's some people here that are here to testify on the legislation. The first thing is there was concern last year that this legislation may be unconstitutional. If you look at your packets, you'll see the Supreme Court ruled early last summer that legislation like this is indeed constitutional. In fact, there is 26 states right now that have some form of mandatory health insurance coverage for mental health. The fiscal note on this is $1.5 million, which works out to be $2.60 per state employee. And I guess I could just say the economic consequences to families of not having this kind of health insurance is certainly severe for some individuals. There is some people here to testify, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'll just yield the floor to them.
I know that the committee is taking up some very important insurance issues, and this in some ways is a small matter, perhaps in the overall view of things, but it's an important matter, I think, for the mentally ill. I'm a member of the Alaska Psychiatric Association. I'm also on the board of the Alaska Mental Health Association, and I'm a member of the Alaska Alliance for the Mentally Ill. These are various groups that are interested in this issue. I think that the passage of a bill like this is really a kind of a policy step for the state, perhaps more than anything else. And the reason it's necessary to do this is because people who are mentally ill are really reluctant to come forward and say that this kind of insurance is needed. I see certain people here in town who depend upon their insurance to help pay for their medical care, and they're frustrated by the fact that their coverage when they see me is about 50%. When they see a general practitioner, it's 80% for the same condition. But I've asked them to write letters or do something, and they say things like, this is just between you and me. I don't want this to go any further, and I'm not about to go down there and talk to somebody about this issue. There's a stigma associated with mental illness. And so if proper coverage for these conditions is left to the marketplace and to negotiated kind of arrangements, it just won't happen because people aren't going to come forward and say they need it. I have not examined the fiscal note, and I don't know whether it took into consideration the fact that the Alaska Psychiatric Institute will probably benefit from the passage of this bill in the sense that it will collect more third-party reimbursement for services that are already delivered there. Now, the number of people who have insurance who go to the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, it's really relatively small. I think it's about 10% of are admitted there actually have insurance coverage. But it's still, the cost of operating the Alaska Psychiatric Institute is something like $13 million, and any amount of that that you can recover is very significant. It's also true that the state funds local mental health clinics, and a number of the people who are seen in those establishments have health insurance, and the revenues from that source will be increased. I might add that I think very often people go to the state-funded mental health clinic rather than to the private sector, because it's a common practice in the local mental health clinic to write off the difference between what they charge, which is comparable to what private practitioners charge, and to write off the difference between what they charge and what the insurance pays. And I think that if the state wants to encourage the use of private practitioners, this would be a good bill to pass. I think that the state will find itself in the situation of, in a sense, paying for the mental health services one way or the other. You'll either do it directly through the operation of local mental health clinics, or you'll do it indirectly through some of the I'd be happy to answer any questions. I did make a couple of suggestions as to how to define who should be paid. I believe that it would be proper to define a physician, a psychiatrist, as a physician who has completed a residency in psychiatry. This is really the common practice. You're an orthopedic surgeon when you've completed an orthopedic surgery residency for insurance purposes. It's really 2 years later that you're board eligible. That is, you can take the test or certify. It has nothing to do with licensure. You're already a licensed practice or competed, as far as there. And the board certification is, you know, is sort of gilding the lily, really, that's on top of all of that. So I think the proper definition of a psychiatrist would be someone who's completed a residency. And I understand that elsewhere there's been some discussion of just exactly what sort of licensing of other groups should take place, such as psychological associates or MSWs or, you know, all of that group. And I think that our advice originally when we were involved in drafting this bill was to suggest that the state basically define a licensed practitioner as those people who are licensed, and if you've licensed them in other statutes, perhaps you should include them here. If not, perhaps you should. Some people simply do not want to go take another examination. They may be quite capable. They certainly have extensive training.
Are there any other questions? Not the same question. Okay, the next witness I'll call George Rogers. I also want to announce for the benefit of the witnesses here. bills up in committee today. I don't want limited testimony, but I will ask you to try to condense your testimony as much as possible.
In line with just that instruction, I'll make my testimony very brief. I will just add a gloss to what Dr. Schrader has spoken. First of all, identify myself. I'm a member of the Juno Alliance of the Mentally Ill. I have a family member who has been mentally ill for 8 years. We've been working very familiar with the services, private and public, in the state. Both the Alliance and ourselves are very much interested in this piece of legislation. It is one in a number of pieces of legislation related to mental illness that the legislature is currently considering. This is a very important component in this, the economic aspect of it. As Dr. Schrader said, this makes possible the payment of costs of treatment. And I think it's very important to mention right at the very beginning that mental illness and nervous conditions are comparable to any other treatment illnesses that are treatable. They are treatable, and as a matter of fairness, equity, they should be considered on a par with other disorders and illnesses that are covered by health insurance. On the matter of the fiscal note, I haven't seen the fiscal note. The amount was $1.5 million. I assume that this is the increased cost to the state of premiums on the employees that are covered by the insurance program. I'd like to emphasize that one of the problems I have with fiscal notes is that they do not take into account savings and other sources of revenue that they generate. In the case of this, I would say this is in the nature of a transfer payment, in that the money that is advanced on premiums would be recoverable in revenues to the state and the local communities that have mental clinics, health clinics, in the form of payments, partial payments. The other is a matter of stigma that Dr. Schrader mentioned. The thing that sets mental illness and disorders, nervous disorders, apart from other forms of illness is the social stigma attached to admitting that you or your family member have such a disorder. Having cancer or something else which may be treatable is not have the same sort of stigma. So we tend to be quiet and don't speak out on these things. I think that this has to be taken into account. This would make it possible that if this is included in your policy, that these disorders, treatment of them, is coverable, that you will seek to have the treatment. But the important thing is to look at the offsetting savings to the state and the revenues that would come from the institution of this program. I endorse everything Dr. Schrader says. I won't repeat that in the interest of brevity. So are there any questions anyone wants to ask?
I'll make a comment. I don't think there's anyone in the legislature who hasn't had a problem with fiscal note at one time.
That's another thing.
I'm going to talk to Dr. Schrader and see if we can't come up with perhaps a more accurate fiscal note in light of what you said, and also Dr. Schrader, because I think they can throw it to you.
I think we can come up with something just based upon the current caseloads of API and the local clinics that would indicate that this in it possibly would be a savings to the state when we net this out.
Are there any questions? I'll note the representative who has joined us. Thank you. Next witness we have is Mark Giardore.
Good afternoon. My name is Martin Tiridor, and I represent Blue Cross of Washington and Alaska, and we appreciate it to appear before this committee. Last session, we testified on this bill, and we would like to take this opportunity to restate some of our concerns. Mandating benefits for specific situations might be an inequitable manner to provide coverage for groups of members. Particularly where you get into situations where benefits are negotiated between an employer and the employees. The negotiation of benefits, rather than mandating benefits, could provide better utilization of what benefit dollars may be available by these corporations or companies. And frequently, or at times, I won't even use the word frequently, but at times, a very tough choice that has to be made by people as to if we have to pay for a mandated benefit, what are we going to have to give up? If you might have to give up basic benefits in order to comply with the state mandated service. Now, this comes to our mind because over 50% of the groups that have a Blue Cross of Washington and Alaska benefit consist of 10 or fewer members. Some of these groups are marginal in the amount of money they can afford to pay for their insurance. And you can, I think, easily see how if they have to give up, they may have to give up bread and butter coverage to provide a specific benefit, whether it be mental health or whether it be exotic medicine or whatever it might be. The large community rated subscriber groups, and community rate is an expression whereby, or a technique whereby, the entire population group provides the base of risk for coverage. And we provide or use the maximum number of 100 to denote a community rated group. So we need as many of these groups as possible to keep insurance claims premiums as low as possible. Organizations have the capacity to self-insure or provide for self-funding for the care of their employees. In this self-funding mechanism, they are exempt from many of the rules and regulations of the Division of Insurance. So this mandate would not have any effect on this self-funding program. And the self-funding is a mandate or is a regulation of the federal government and not a state government. The more of these people that leave the risk base, the higher the premiums are going to be for those people that are remaining. I think that doesn't really require an awful lot of thinking on my part anyway to see that. We hear that mandated benefits, particularly in the area of mental health, reduce the need for basic insurance coverage. Now, I don't know whether that is true or not. I haven't seen, anyway, to my satisfaction, statistics that prove it. I will concede that there is an interface between mental health and physical health, but just to what level, can't say. I would suggest that the legislature or this committee look at the development of some mechanism that would parallel the state fiscal note system. When you're looking at costs to the state of Alaska for anything, you ask them to say, what's it going to cost, which is a fair and reasonable statement. I think that also it's fair and reasonable to ask us to say, okay, we want this benefit, this is what it's going to cost. And not only for the, you know, this is for the private sector, not for the state of Alaska, but look at the entire private sector. This is one of the ways I feel that we can provide a good protective umbrella for the buying public. In addition, you might want to consider adopting programs similar to that of Senator Fakes, who has proposed a mandated offering. In contrast to a mandated benefit, this would require us to offer you, the buying public, an option to buy a nervous and mental condition benefit. Some of the things in the bill that I stated last year that we have problems with is looking at page one, for instance, it appears to me on line 14 that anybody related to the subscriber could be covered by this bill. I think that we want to look at changing the language of the bill to make it only those eligible covered family members. Bring it down to getting into page 2, lines 18 through 27, defining nervous and mental conditions. Pardon me. This language is vague, and I think it caused some problems in claims adjudication. This would probably require a third-party payer to require untold amounts of paperwork that would accompany claims. This increases the cost of providing the service, increases the cost of adjudicating claims. The American Psychiatric Association has within their system a code and diagnostic criteria that would assist the practitioners in claims filing people in determining whether a disorder falls into a nervous condition situation. The bill provides for care supervised by a psychological associate. I had not been acquainted with the term, looked it up, and in the statutes, that individual has a doesn't have a great deal of leeway, as I understand the statute, in providing care. That is care, the care provided by an associate must be supervised by a psychologist, and the associate is limited to a certain menu of therapy that he can provide, and this menu is on file with the division. And the care programs must be approved by the supervising psychologist. This, I think, would make it expensive because persons consulting an associate would also have to consult a psychologist, and you're getting into a double pay situation.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'd said that I don't want to go into testimony. I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your comments as quickly as possible. I have opportunity again to comment on the bill, but I want to make sure that I give everyone here a chance.
There's only one other definition I'd like for you to consider, and that's the definition of inpatient treatment. We suggest you use the same definition that is used in existing statute, which we suggest would be something admitted to and have and be under continuous treatment during a 24-hour period. That would be on page, well, in the definition section. I won't bother. I'm sorry to have taken so much of your time, but if there's any questions, we'll try to hurry the answer.
Are there any questions?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for letting me testify.
is Bladeberg. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, and I'm executive director of the South Central Counseling Center, which is the mental health center in the Anchorage area. Let me first state I believe in free enterprise system, and I believe in just compensation to insurance companies. If there's an additional cost in this measure, then I think those of us who buy insurance should pay that cost. It appears that this is obvious, that there would be a greater cost. But I ask you to consider it carefully. Will there really be a greater cost to the insurance companies? First, my field is mental health, and I really can't tell you what's mental health and what's physical health. At one time, I had a hole in my stomach they called an ulcer that caused me to be hospitalized and about 3 years of intensive medical care, which did me no good because this was an emotional problem. When I took care of the emotional problems, the hole in my stomach went away. There isn't a neat dividing line between physical and mental health. We are one person and they are very closely related. To exclude a category of conditions by calling them mental health really is an arbitrary and artificial procedure. Second, when we talk about costs, medical costs, remember that early intervention, particularly in mental health, but also in physical health, is far cheaper than later intervention. One situation, for instance, the cost that we came up with was $79 per week as opposed to $1,400 per week for care when it becomes more intensive. In the final analysis, either the individuals or the state has to bear that cost. And we're in a time of shrinking revenues. I'm not sure the state can bear that cost. And if people do not have proper coverage, medical coverage, they will not seek the early intervention. Next, I'm not at all convinced that it is more expensive. I just found out about this hearing, and I apologize for not being able to get my information, but I promise I will supply it to the Senate. I attended a lecture given by the former Speaker of the House for the state of Montana. They had done very intensive actuarial studies on this problem and had found to their amazement that actually the claims, now I'm reporting hearsay to you, but this is my best understanding, and I talked today to the Montana Association and they said yes, that was their finding, that actually the cost of claims goes down, not up, if you include mental health coverage. Now this is one of the reasons that's been mentioned. So many conditions are treated forever as a physical condition when they are not. Also, it's because if a person is emotionally ill, he will almost inevitably become physically ill. I had a recent case of this, which makes this point. I had a person sent to me by a physician. This person had been treated by five very fine physicians over a period of almost 6 years, if I remember correctly, for a very severe headache situation they could not diagnose. Finally, they decided it must be psychological, and they sent them to me for diagnosis. Now, this person does not have a physical ailment. He is developing schizophrenia, which is a mental illness. Tens of thousands of dollars have been spent treating him for something that did not exist. Upon being put on an antipsychotic medication, within a very short period of days, his symptoms went away. This is the reason that claims go down if you have mental health coverage. I know I'm taking time, and I'll try and hurry. There's a policy issue involved here. With the high indicia of mental distress in the state of Alaska, we lead the nation across the boards. We're always one or two. Can we really afford as a state to let this continue and not address the problem, or should we do everything we can to lower that and so lower your costs of prison, upkeep, people committed to there, your court costs, all of the other intended societal costs like abused children and the other things that happen when you do not cannot address mental health problems, I submit to you as a college teacher, you cannot afford not to address mental health problems. There's also a human issue involved. You know, I study history. Many of you, I'm sure, do. Every time that an advance in the basic humanity of a society occurs, it has a cost. And it is always opposed as being too expensive. But society actually has become more prosperous as these advances have taken place. And I suggest to you, as a human issue, if we address this very human problem, that in the long run it will bring prosperity to our state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Not a question, I just really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Next witness is Gordon Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gordon Evans. I'm an attorney with general law firm of Guest Run. I've been asked to present the position of the Health Insurance Association of America with relation to this particular bill. HIAA is a National Association of Private Health Insurance companies based in Chicago. HIAA generally opposes this bill, and their position is based on three points. The first point, obviously, is that requiring coverage for treatment of a mental or health or nervous condition will increase the basic level of costs for health insurance policies. The second point, which is related to the first, is that the bill would add mandated benefits to all health insurance policies. HIAA feels that there should be a freedom of choice, that an insured should have the option of choosing the policy benefits and the premium levels that suit them, that fit their budget and their needs, and they should not be forced to pay for benefits that they may not wish to have or may not be able to pay for. Finally, HIAA feels that this bill would be discriminatory in that, as written, it would unfairly impose burdens on private insurance companies because only private insurance companies would be subject to this mandate. Those businesses or employers which self-insure would be free from any requirement to offer treatment for a mental or nervous condition under their plan, since the bill by definition, and that's under 2142-365C3 of the bill, applies only to a hospital or medical expense policy or nonprofit health care corporation plan. It doesn't apply to self-insurance. And it would, we believe, create a disincentive for employers to buy private insurance, in fact, create an incentive for them to self-insure and avoid any state regulation. That is the basic policy position of HIAA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'll just go back to this article that indicated that there's 26 states that have some kind of mandatory coverage, and I assume your organization probably opposes legislation or at least the that mandated coverage in each one of the states.
I think they have.
They probably see the setback.
The Supreme Court decision that Ms. Lobal was referring to?
That's correct.
I wasn't sure whether she was referring to the Massachusetts Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, it's
because my understanding from HIAA is that that ERISA at this point does not or would not affect that. So.
It was actually Massachusetts brought it before the Supreme Court, but it was the U.S. decision.
I wasn't aware of that. No, and I have to tell you that HIAA did not mention it to me when I discussed this with them. I would be glad to check with them, and if I do know that I talked to them yesterday, they still oppose the nation.
Thank you.
Representative Davis, I was just wondering how many states the statute that requires this type of coverage.
Yep.
And I mean, this, not as an option, but as a mandatory.
Some form of mandate coverage. That's 2016. Some form of mandate, you know, where they mandate that they offer them coverage, but it's optional. But I can't give you how many states have this form of coverage. I don't have that information.
I would just say I know that Wisconsin does, and according to HIAA, they indicate that Wisconsin was the only state that actually had mandated for particular for health conditions, mental and nervous conditions, and others required as part of alcohol and drug abuse treatment, stuff like that. But as a mandate for this particular type of coverage, they indicated to me that it's only Wisconsin. I am supposed to be receiving some more information. I'll be glad to make it available to you when I get it. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Hanley, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm looking at mandated benefits compared to mandated offerings. And thinking about the mandated offerings, I'm assuming that means that, as in some cases, vision and dental are not mandated benefits, but they're optional, and the person can opt into those benefits. I guess then we're talking about being able to opt into the coverage for some of the mental health conditions that we're talking about here. Also thinking about what Mrs. Lobar said, and that no one ever anticipates ever having to use that kind of coverage, but also wouldn't it be wouldn't you anticipate that that would be an expensive kind of optional offering? If we had a mandated offering, I would anticipate it would be pretty expensive.
That was my understanding, it would be. I could get that information for you too and get back to you.
I would appreciate that, since I think that's important to find out how much of a cost this is going to.
We do.
Okay.
Well, we do have some. One of the members of my staff brought it forward. Some of the states have mandated mental health coverage. It's Colorado, Connecticut, Maine, North Dakota, Oregon. So there is a number of other states.
Are these all that require exactly like?
No. I didn't. No, not exactly. Have some form of mandated mental health coverage. It's in. It's a House Research report. I'll be glad to get a copy of it.
I apologize about that information today. I talked to them yesterday. They said they would try to get it to me by today, but apparently Chicago can't make the connection with Juno on one day, unfortunately.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next witness is Lee Allison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lee Powelson, I'm with the Alaska Public Employees Association. And I'll comment on this bill as it affects public employees of collective bargaining. Health insurance is an issue which is negotiated under collective bargaining agreements. The agreements which DPD has with the state of Alaska expired this year, and negotiations are tentatively set to begin in the late fall, probably November, following the senatorial election. We believe that mandatory coverage, as this bill provides, may be handled in the same way that
meeting we had in Petersburg and some people testifying there, I would say elderly people, but older people that had dropped out of group insurance, that they had rather a difficult time getting any of their own health coverage, primarily because of some restrictions they're running into on pre-existing conditions, pre-existing illnesses, which the large group policies don't get into too much. We come to work here for the state, they hire us whether we have pre-existing illnesses and coverages or not. So taking that problem, we went on to expand it to say, well, why don't we just do what we've done in automobiles? We have an assigned risk pool, and with automobile insurance, if you can't get it anywhere else, you can go to this assigned risk pool, and we require all people who write automobile insurance in the state to participate in the pool. So what this bill basically does is say all people who write health insurance in the state shall participate in a pool concept to provide health coverage for those who are able to get it anywhere else. And that's the concept that was presented to the drafters, and this beautiful 9-page bill came flying back. 10-page bill. We have good drafters around here. So that's the essence of the bill, and if you go through it, what it does, it creates a comprehensive health insurance association. And the concept or the philosophy is to require all the writers of health insurance to participate in it. Now, there's an area that you can get technical and say, what should all of it be in it? Should self-insurance be in it? Or what level? Maybe they should write so much coverage in the state before they're required to participate. But I don't know if that's what you want to get into today, but there are some areas there that need to be discussed. And also then it gets into the other big issue once you take through all the technical aspects of how this works and writes, you get to section 250 of the bill, page 8, line 24, where I put in a provision, what's the maximum rate they can charge for this coverage. It's no magic number. It says it can't exceed by 25% more than the other average insurance. That's not a real hard point with me. The point is to make it available and to put this in a position where it's really no cost to the state. I don't really care to get into the subsidy situation. So I think we need to put a mechanism in here that the coverage will be made available, but the rate may have to be adjusted, or the direct provision insurance may have to have the authority to adjust the rate or put some other concepts. And there are some different ideas that can be articulated on that matter. And there's a couple other points in the bill I'm sure that other people in the industry will bring up regarding the specific type of language that is used, and some of the words aren't the exact precise words that the insurance industry uses. Though I use insurance, I'm not exactly sure exactly how it comes. But that's the essence of it. I would like also, Mr. Chairman, this time, and I realize that it's not before your committee, it wasn't introduced till Friday, but there's another bill, House Bill 589, that relates to this a little bit. I put it out in your packets. And again, it's to the same concept of trying to provide health insurance coverage to the residents of the state of Alaska. And what that bill proposes to do, and I'm sure you'll get in it at a later date, is to open up the state's health insurance plan to residents of the state of Alaska. If you're a resident, that you can make application to participate in the state of Alaska's health plan. And the state will tell you how much it's going to cost to charge an administrative fee. So again, it's a no-cost concept to the state, because to take our group plan and make it available to all the residents of the state. And that's not in front of this committee today. I'm just bringing it up because it's the same philosophy of trying to make health coverage available to people in the state of Alaska. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just thinking a little bit about what you just said about the other plan, and would it then be the individual's responsibility to pay for that once we make the state insurance available to people across the board, perhaps? Okay. So they would at least have group insurance available to them, but would that be requiring other insurance companies then to contribute to a pool as this bill does?
That's correct. It could be done that way. Again, this is a pool insurance, and the only way you can get into this pool is you have to be turned down for insurance coverage by other bodies. That's the idea of a signed risk pool. There's a requirement in here that you have to show that you were unable to get coverage in any other by any other carrier for a similar type of coverage. And only then can you make application to get into the assigned risk pool. So the concepts are a little bit different, but still.
So it's providing coverage to people who otherwise can't receive it for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
state by appreciation. This is my second trip up here from Seattle in 2 weeks, and on both occasions, it kept the sun shining and the temperature relatively reasonably comfortable for those of us who are not acclimated to your complete climate. Blue Cross recognizes the problems that are trying to be addressed by this bill, the problems of a high-risk individual who does not get coverage in the usual programs. We understand it to be a major problem. We have looked at this bill rather substantially over the last week since we received a copy of it, and unfortunately would like to talk about some of the problems from the point of view of the insurance industry that are in this bill. I will try to be as concise as possible, but I do have a number of points section by section that I would like to go through. In the first section, the division that talks about membership includes insurers, health maintenance organizations, and self-insurers. And I see three problems there. The first one is that I believe you do mean to include Blue Cross as one of the types of companies that would be included in the association. However, we're not an insurer, we are not an HMO, and we're not a self-insurer. We're a hospital medical service corporation, and as such, we are not included in this bill. An oversight, I am sure, I bring it to your attention. I really want to be in it, but because I think that you do intend to include all people providing health and disability insurance in the state, and we're not there. The second problem with the definition of membership is that you talk of HMOs that are licensed or authorized in this state, and you have no law that either licenses or authorizes HMOs. And third, you include self-insurers. And I know in the last bill there was a great deal of talk about the Massachusetts court case that went to the United States Supreme Court. That is not the issue here. The issue is that you have not defined the term, and the overall ERISA, the Employees Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, passed by the federal government, has a clause in it that precludes state insurance laws from impacting any employer who self-funds the benefits for their employees. I believe you will find that this association cannot, because of federal law, include employers who self-fund because you are amending an insurance law, and ERISA clearly does not allow an insurance law to apply to a self-funded employee benefit program put together by an employer. If that is correct, and I believe my information there is correct, this proposal once again will impact those of us who are in the business of healthcare coverage and make self-funding of benefits much more attractive to companies that can go into that. The state of Alaska, when benefits are self-funded, loses its control to require adequate reserves of those companies, to come up with a reasonable benefit design that protects the citizens of the state of Alaska, and to have any control over consumer protection issues, such as the unfair claims practices, which is in a bill before you tomorrow afternoon. In section 2155.030 on your general powers, you allow the association to sue and to be sued. You do not specify what limits the members of the association would be at risk at on the issue of being sued. Is it limited to the assets of the association, or would a suit be able to tap the non-risk pool assets of the carriers who are required to participate in the association if they are going to do business in the state of Alaska? In our litigious society, I don't believe that's an idle question. I think it's a question that we believe will hit at our reserves and hit them hard and enable us, keep us from being unable to provide adequate coverage for the citizens of the state. In section 2155.050, you exempt the association from the Administrative Procedures Act. However, you create it in the opening section as a nonprofit incorporated legal entity, which, as our legal counsel looked at it, is not a state agency anyway. It is an agency governed under Chapter 10.20 of the Alaska statutes, and we're not too sure when you exempt it what you are exempting under APA. You give the Division of Insurance the authority to write regulations to do things with this. Do you exempt the Division of Insurance from the APA requirements on notice requirements for regulations and things of this sort? I hope that that section will be looked at, because I think there is an exemption problem there that is not completely clear. In section 2155.120, subsection B on page 5, you indicate, or you infer at least, that an employer may cover his, quote, bad risk, unquote, employees through this program. That abrogates the idea of group insurance as we know it. It will legalize the dumping
welcome that, since it will enable them to offer a price to an employer only for the good risk employees that are in that group, with anyone who has a chronic or a progressive condition being able to be moved over into this state risk pool. We believe it will become a standard business decision and it should not be encouraged. In subsection C on the same page, on the same section, you said an 85% loss ratio. You state that as a percent of what you are calling state plan premiums, which you do not define. Where we're questioning is, does that term mean only the premium paid by the subscriber, the 125% figure of an average cost of a policy? Which, if it does, then the writing carrier will, in our opinion, be unable to meet that loss ratio. If state plan premium also includes the subsidization that is in this bill from insurers doing business in the state, you can probably expect that 85% will come close enough to where we're going to be just about able to break even on administrative costs and claims payment costs. But the very fact that in Section 2155-240 you give advertising and referral fees as a definite charge to the writing carrier, you are increasing the costs, or at least requiring specific costs for that type of promotion. And our actuarial estimates are that the claims paid can be expected to be about 200 to 300% of subscriber premium, just knowing the type of risk of Pearson's that will be in this program. Eligibility, Section 2155-200, is stated on this as one rejection, one rider, or a pre-existing condition limitation for, quote, substantially similar coverage. The term substantially similar coverage bothers us from the point of view that I don't know how you define it. Individual coverages from Blue Cross in this state now offer the individual purchasing it the right to either take a $200 deductible, a $500 deductible, or a $1,000 deductible. The benefits are about the same. The premium charged for it differs because of the upfront out-of-pocket costs that the individual agrees to pay. Is the $200 policy substantially similar to the $1,000 policy? Our actuary says no. But you're using substantially similar coverage, and I think it's a term that you're going to have trouble defining. Most standard contracts, group contracts in this state, have pre-existing condition limits. In fact, this bill has one in a further section in here. It requires that anyone who had treatment during the last 90 days is not going to be covered for that condition during the first 6 months of the coverage of this policy. That's standard in almost every group policy that I know of. If that type of a limitation, and that's what this language says, pre-existing condition limitation, is enough to trigger the person into the high-risk pool, then I don't believe that that individual belongs there and that eligibility based on pre-existing limitation should be stricken from the bill. One rejection is another issue on this. Other state laws and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which wrote model legislation to be looked at by states for background for passing bills of this sort, require rejection from two companies. It's not an onerous requirement. Many people apply first to Blue Cross, then to Aetna, or first to Aetna, and then to Blue Cross, and may be rejected twice for a condition that will not be covered under normal underwriting guidelines. But it is a more realistic standard if this is talking of two rejections than only one. Eligibility that is based on a rider is also not realistic. It assures, in my estimation, that this state program will cover persons who could receive standard coverage with reasonable restrictions. We have found in conditions where we are ridering out that the information included in an application often is misunderstood, and that further correspondence on the issue or conversation on the issue between our medical review people and the physician of the patient who is asking for coverage overturns the idea that we were going to put a rider on the first place. So if you're talking of one rider, I think you are again opening up this pool to people who should not be in it. 2155-210 sub 2 allows spouse and children to be covered in the high-risk pool. It would make no sense for me, economically, to cover either my son or my daughter, who are perfectly healthy 20-year-olds, in a high-risk plan, because I could purchase coverage for them as an individual, given their health statement, someplace else at far less than 125% of premium. Therefore, in our estimation, the spouse children coverage is a meaningless provision and probably should be stricken from the bill. In section 2155-240 and subsection C and D, you seem to unnecessarily increase the cost. In C, you require a $50 referral fee to an agent. In D, you put in a requirement that a rejected applicant be notified by the insurer who rejects them that they have, that there is this coverage available from the state. We see this as, in many cases, a place where the patient is, or the applicant is going to know that coverage is available and that an agent can get away with a $50 fee that might not be necessarily have to be paid except for the requirement in sub B in this section. The maximum premium in 2155-250 is set at 125% of the average of rates covered by five insurers covering the largest number of Alaskans with coverage. If this premium is to be realistic, that determination should be based on five insurers who are offering individual non-group coverage. There's an inference that that's what you mean, but it's not clearly stated, and we believe that it has to relate to individual coverage because group coverages with the larger number of people involved and without the adverse selection that will be in this program are totally different in price. We think there should also be a requirement that the premium should be based on age-rated products and that this product itself should be age-rated so that there is a premium charge for the 25 to 30-year-old that will be different than the 50 to 55-year-old because there is a great difference in the utilization of benefits between ages younger and older. It should also be a requirement in the law that the cap of 125% be reviewed annually and raised as needed as carriers refile their rates and to assure that it remains reasonable. To effect this, you may want to allow the Division of Insurance both to set the cap and to review and change it as necessary. You talk of a premium for HMOs, seemingly, as it's written, accepted per se on what it is that each HMO charges, so that your HMO premium is based per HMO simply. Medicare rate contracts with HMOs covering Medicare-eligible persons are based on a correlation to 95% of the fee-for-service charges in the same area. You may want to look at the language on the premiums to HMOs so that there is some comparability between the 125% limit and what an HMO would charge for these people. In summary, we oppose the proposal in its present form. It will, due to the federal requirements of ERISA, make the provision of coverage more expensive for admitted carriers while allowing employers who self-fund their benefits to provide coverage over which the State Division of Insurance has no control. It would, as drafted, allow employers to shift their chronic higher-risk employees over to the pool, lowering their insurance costs at the expense of all other insured persons in the state. And if a self-funded employer were to do this, he or she would escape the cost entirely. The eligibility requirements need to be more stringent. And as a final comment, Blue Cross, either through Martin Tirador, who is here on a full-time basis, or any of the rest of us who can be reached by phone and can come in as necessary, would be pleased to assist you or your staff in any way that we can as you work on this legislation. We recognize it's the problem you are trying to deal with. It's a problem in many, many states. We're facing it in several other areas. Urge you to fashion a solution that does not unfairly impact those of us who are striving to provide affordable coverage for the citizens of this state. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions, but I apologize for being so lengthy.
It's okay. Thank you very much. Representative Collins.
Thank you. I'd like to compliment you on your presentation. I'd really like to have it in writing.
I will type it and send it to you.
And I think you brought up some good points. I guess my concern is that there, in my experience, no
comments especially short now because primarily we endorse the comments we just made by the previous witness. And there are a couple of things. Again, we do not believe that because of ERISA that you can include self-insurers in the bill, and they are included in the way it's drafted. There is one way, of course, that pending right now, there's federal legislation pending, the Kennelly bill, I believe it is, in Congress, which would require that private employers, actually, I should say, create an incentive to have self-insurers to participate in these pools. That would be, it would require them in order to get a federal tax deduction for the employee benefits plan to actually join such pools as you're planning. That may or may not pass, but HIAA's position is that they cannot support the bill as it's presently written, but they are interested in working with you and trying to come up with some.
Thank you very much, Senator Davis.
I guess just a general question. Your firm that you're representing is not opposed to the idea that just opposed to some of the its present form, but thing this thing was massaged a little bit, you might have come out of support.
That was the general impression I received from him. The big problem is including self-insurers, and somehow you have to make it all equitable to include everybody.
Okay, House Bill 547 will also be held over, and again, I don't have anybody else listed to testify on that. And I'll ask once again if anybody failed to sign. Judge of the Division of Insurance.
Thank you. For the record, John George, Director of Insurance. We have a position paper, basically. It's not in favor of the bill. I think Representative Sun's comments that he was willing to be flexible and talk about how the maximum premiums and that puts a lot of our basic problems at ease. And I think, you know, with that, it could be worked out where we, would might at least be neutral on the bill. Recognize that the state of Alaska is one of the largest premium payers on health insurance in the state, and therefore insurance company for the state of Alaska will ultimately end up picking up a large piece of the assigned risk portion of this, which means that they've got to make it up somewhere, which means that it will probably raise the cost of employee benefits. Maybe. I don't have any idea what that cost would be, and I'm not sure the Department of Admin, but that ultimately it's going to get spread back to those who pay the premiums, and the state of Alaska is probably the largest buyer of health insurance in the state. We have a fiscal note on this, and in doing the 14 fiscal notes today on the insurance bills, we did somewhat have to throw some things together, and we're not sure exactly what some of the ramifications of this bill are. And so, these are subject possibly to some adjustment. It said that we would go out and promote the availability of this coverage, and we can do that by contractor in-house. What does it cost to promote that, and what a number of contractual services for it. We believe that there is enough requirement on us that it would probably take a fairly high-level employee, if we put in range 21, to administer this and set up the regulations and review health insurance rates, which we don't do now. Those are not subject to rate filings. We have to create rate filings, compare those, determine essential or coverage that is essentially the same, who was writing it, and how much was available. That's would create a fair administrative burden on us. These numbers pulled out this morning is being relatively what we thought the bill would do, but they are subject to revision when we figure out exactly what the bill is going to do to us. Just give up with that. Is there any questions?
Representative Davis? I don't have a question on this specific piece of legislation, but we've heard from all areas of the insurance industry and the people being involved in insurance, and we really haven't heard your side of the story on that. We've heard from other people saying that the Division of Insurance needs more money to do their job, and that's going to have an effect on the rates. And I think at some point it would be nice if, we're dealing with this question of insurance and liability and tort reform and whatever else you want to call it. But I would like, Mr. Chairman, if we could have you come to the committee and just talk to us from your perspective on the whole insurance question, whether it's from as a division director or as a person that's intimately involved in the issue or whatever. Call the forum, but I just think you probably have some things that you could share with the community. I'd like to do that. right after this meeting, we can talk.
Fine. I expect to be seeing a lot of you this year, and Representative Davidson, at this point, we'll just be getting on insurance, and I'm getting an overview of all the bills, and I intend to have more than a few work sessions on insurance issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on 587? If not, that bill will be held over. We have one other bill to put in the name, House Bill 506, an act relating to insurance and providing an effective date. Representative Taylor is a prime sponsor. Also note for the record the presence of Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ross Taylor, representing District 1A. Distributed just now to you as sponsor substitute for House Bill 506. I had assumed we had it earlier and probably got a chance to see it. We do have a sectional analysis that has been done by Terry Lauterbach, who's been assisting us in drafting. We've also had the assistance of the Division of Insurance in advising and assisting in the creativity, if you will, of this piece of legislation. I'd first like to make a few general comments before addressing the particulars within the bill, and realizing that the hour is very late and it's a very warm and stuffy room, I don't intend to go into much detail on this bill at this time. But I believe, Mr. Chairman, that we have an insurance crisis ongoing in this state. This room is filled today and has been for a couple of days. We've seen almost 13 or 14 pieces of different legislation attempting to address various aspects of this insurance crisis. This insurance crisis is being driven by exorbitant fees that are being required of our business and municipal communities. I think it's interesting to note for the committee that there are two entities in this state right now that are not affected by the insurance crisis as we know it. The first entity is the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska does not have liability insurance as such, and it's the liability portion of the insurance market that's driving these premiums that are out of sight. The state of Alaska, some years ago, decided that we would become self-insured, and I'm assuming that the reasons that we did this is that the high cost of paying an insurance company to administer our risk management problems in this state seemed ridiculous. So someone in administration made the wise and, I believe, intelligent decision. And that was that we would manage our own risks, that we as Alaskans and as the state of Alaska would handle within this state our risks of liability, and that we had a sufficient fund of money, capital, if you will, that we could handle any conceivable catastrophic loss that might occur. That has been true. And as a consequence, this state has saved millions and millions of dollars since making that decision. Just recently, the city of Anchorage opted to do the same thing. So they are no longer, quote, affected, if you will, by these high insurance and reinsurance rates. In seeking a solution for this insurance crisis, I looked to not only those two examples and how they had solved this problem, but also to previous experiences that I had in the private sector involved with the timber industry, where I watched a group of loggers in 1967 in Ketchikan form their own workman's compensation carrier because they felt the rates were too high for their industry. In essence, that business has now been operating for 19 years. They are a small reciprocal insurance carrier. They handle all of their own claims in that industry. They charge 40% less than what the market currently charges for an insurance premium in the workman's compensation field. And every year for 19 years, they have paid a retro payment back to their membership of monies that were left over. They have never had a claim in 19 years that went through their basic coverage and into what would be called their reinsurance or their blanket coverage over the top. And yet this year they were forced to increase their premiums because the reinsurance market sent them a bill for $900,000 on a policy that's never had a claim filed on it in 19 years. Faced with those realities, the reality that the reinsurance market is not regulated in the state of Alaska or in the United States, that it is not even subject to the antitrust laws of this state or of the United States, insurance commissioner and his department have no idea whether or not the reinsurance carriers in this state doing business here made a profit or had a loss. We sincerely suspect at this point that they made a profit, a sizable one. Their profits this year would be astronomical in light of what has happened. We as a state require, through our statute law and regulations, various businesses to carry mandatory amounts of insurance. The truckers have to carry certain amounts of insurance to operate on our highways. The air carriers have to carry certain amounts of insurance. And this is true of many other entities. And yet, some of these businesses, not only can they not afford the policies that they're presently being offered, for some businesses, there is no policy even available. The best example I can give you is a small air taxi operator in Ketchikan, my home community, which has been operating for over 20 years. They were offered a liability premium this year in excess of $24,000. That represents more than 25% of their total gross income last year and more than their net income for last year. Needless to say, they can't pay that premium. Both of their 185 aircraft are tied up today in their hangar, and their business is for sale. Because they are no longer in business legally, they can't fly without insurance, and they certainly can't afford that kind of a premium. The bill that I bring before you today offers an opportunity, and I believe it's the only piece of legislation that this committee will be considering this year, which offers an opportunity to reduce rates. In essence, this bill gives to every municipality, every school district, every association like the Air Carriers Association, CHAR, Workers Association, it gives them the opportunity to form their own insurance pool, their own reciprocal insurance company if they want to, their own joint underwriting or a joint insurance arrangement. By so doing, they become self-policing. They determine who's going to be in the pool and who isn't. They determine what risks they're going to assume and what they're not. They would then carry basic coverage for their membership. They would administer their own claims in state. If a claim occurred, you wouldn't be telling the victim that they had to call Albuquerque and wait for 2 weeks to get a letter back. Instead, there would be an adjuster there on site before the dust had settled and the matter would be resolved between Alaskans. I think that the example set by the Alaska Timber Exchange in Ketchikan will very clearly show this committee how effective that can be. This bill will allow that to happen. It'll also allow for one additional thing, and that is if reinsurance is not available, or if reinsurance is so expensive that it is no longer affordable, then the state would establish a fund upon which premiums could be written that would provide that reinsurance for those industries and associations who are unable to find insurance in the market or unable to afford it. Many people have asked me, Representative Taylor, my God, you're putting the state in the insurance business. The bottom line is, yes, I suppose we are in the reinsurance business. The main thrust of this bill, however, is to put private enterprise into the insurance business, to let them run their own insurance programs. Only if it's unaffordable, only if it's unavailable, would the state get involved. People have then said, what would the cost of this be to the state? Interestingly enough, if done in an actuarially sound fashion, I sincerely doubt that there will be a cost to the state. In fact, there should be a revenue enhancement, if you will, an income stream to the state, far and away more profitable than some of the present investments that this state is involved in. The concepts that are involved here are very deep, are very sophisticated to some extent, and certainly I'm not an expert and not able to testify on them. There are people here available to do that, and I'll be happy to provide this committee with witnesses from not only the insurance industry, but also the legal community and others who are uniquely involved in this area that can speak to it. I might mention that just since this bill was initiated, the Alaska Municipal League has been out working diligently to form their own reciprocal insurance corporation. They were searching not only within their membership to find a sufficient agreement to do that, which I believe they've now achieved, but their underwriter, the man who's been assisting, the company's been assisting them in this, reinsurance carrier in the lower 48 after searching quite diligently. Those municipalities that belong to that association may very soon become self-insured, just as is contemplated within this bill. I would hope, Mr. Chairman, that we might be able to, in our discussions of this piece of legislation, avoid some of the acrimony and emotion that's bound to come along with the various special interest groups that are arguing over the revamping of our civil justice system, because this bill is outside of that. It addresses my bit of issue, and it doesn't address questions of tort reform or questions of legal propriety or the size of judgments or settlements. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I realize there's very little time left today, and I certainly appreciate the chairman giving me the opportunity to speak today. I would recommend to you the review of the sectional analysis, and of course we have various experts we can send to you, and we really appreciate your indulgence today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Representative Taylor. The purpose today is an overview of the bill, and we will be doing more work later. Are there questions for Representative Taylor? Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Taylor. Example you gave the municipal thing is really intriguing. Do you think that the bill, which helps various groups set up reciprocals, can be achieved, or that purpose can be achieved without the state doing the other half of the what you referred to as the reinsurance work?
Yes, it can. However, to really be truly effective, I think we're going to have to move into the reinsurance market.
Is it okay, Mr. Chairman? I just have two or three questions.